This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon, I'm Meera Sivasuthi. Adrian Rain is a Richard Perry University Professor of Criminology, Psychiatry and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. His recent book, The Anatomy of Violence, investigates the physiological roots of violence and was selected as a New Scientist Best Book of 2013. We're pleased to have him on the line with us to explore neurocriminology and the biological roots of crime. Welcome to the show, Adrian. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Adrian, the scientific study of crime got its start on a cold, grey November morning in 1871 on the east coast of Italy. Cesare Lombroso, I understand, was a psychiatrist and a prison doctor at an asylum for the criminally insane. And his theories, made an impact on the on the community dealing with criminals. How did his name, what does his name do to you? I mean, is there an impact at all for Lombroso's work?
Well, he's a bit like the ghost of Christmas past, because in some ways he had at that time a very innovative view, a new idea that there is indeed a brain basis to crime and violence. He was looking on that morning inside a skull. He'd done an autopsy on a prisoner. And looking there, he saw an indentation in the base of the skull, which he interpreted as a brain abnormality. And in that flash of lightning there, he got the idea that there is a brain basis to crime. So he was very influential throughout Europe for about 30 years. But his biological theorizing fell into disrepute. It even fed into the eugenics movement, and Nazi Germany latched onto his theorizings. So, in the past 100 years, we've really instead swung right away from biology and instead focused on the social environment as the prime and only cause of crime.
But most people ask, why are you so deeply uncomfortable with the implications of neurocriminology?
Well, I think that the idea is people think that, well, if it's biological, then we can't change it. But actually, we can. Biology is not destiny. We can change the brain basis to crime and violence. There's lots of different ways that we can do this. Drugs actually have an impact. Drugs are actually very effective in reducing aggressive and violent behavior in children. But we don't even need to recourse to drugs. We can use natural medication like omega-3 or fish oil to change the brain for the better, to change behavior. So more and more I'm thinking that the social environment is only a part of the equation. The other part of the equation is biological and brain functioning. And I think it's critical for us to understand more the notion that there is in part a brain basis to antisocial, violent, and psychopathic behavior.
What do you mean by neurocriminology?
Well, neurocriminology is a new subfield that I'm trying to develop, which is applying neuroscience techniques like brain imaging, molecular genetics, to understand the causes and the ultimate cures of crime. So things like brain imaging, that's a neuroscience technique looking at neurons in the brain and looking to see, well, how do murderers, for example, compare to completely normal people? Are the brains the same? Are they different? Or what?
But do you not think then society would probably, by acknowledging this so-called biological risk, it could result in society taking a softer approach to crime?
Well, yes, it could. And I think that's another one of those concerns that you allude to, that there is a concern that, for example, if we find that a murderer had abnormal brain functioning in a way that could have predisposed him to commit violence, and if he was not responsible for the brain impairment, then the question comes, should we really punish him? Should we punish him as harshly as we do today? So let me try and give you some examples of the type of things that can lead to brain impairment. Mm-hmm. If a mother is pregnant and if she smokes during pregnancy, we know that her offspring are three times more likely to become violent criminal offenders. Why? Well, nicotine and the carbon monoxide in the smoking shuts off oxygen to the fetus. Mm-hmm. It impairs fetal brain development. And if you have bad brains, then bad behavior will result. That's one thing. We also know from many other studies that women during pregnancy with poor nutrition, their offspring are 2.5 times more likely to be antisocial. If a mum takes alcohol during pregnancy, alcohol is neurotoxic to the brain, meaning it damages the brain. And we also know that those offspring, 50% of them will be arrested during their teenage years. So there are basic health factors early on in life that negatively affect the brain, that raise the odds that the offspring will become violent. But we can change that. We can change that. Pregnant women can reduce smoking, alcohol consumption, and eat better diets to help their fetus and reduce later crime and violence in society.
What about genetically? Isn't there a link?
Certainly. I mean, we've been doing studies on twins and documenting that 50% of antisocial, violent criminal behavior can be chalked up to genetic factors. Now, that means that the environment is still important. About half of it is due to the environment. But all of a sudden, we're recognizing that genes are important too. What do these genes do? Well, they code for brain changes and neurotransmitter changes, which affect emotion, affect the way we think, and affect the way that we behave. So we're still trying to understand which specific genes lead to what forms of violent and criminal behavior. But nowadays, there's absolutely no question whatsoever that genetic factors can account for half of the crime and violence that we see in society.
Professor, I'm assuming that you work with fMRIs to, read brain waves and how they actually function amongst criminals. What have you found out so far?
Well, the most replicated, meaning the strongest finding that we and many other groups have, is that violent offenders and psychopaths have much poorer functioning in the very front region of the brain. It's called the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
It's a part of the brain that sits right above your eyes and lies just behind your forehead. What does this part of the brain do? It does two important things. It checks on your impulsive behavior. If you have an impulse to steal something from a shop or to lash out and hit someone, it's your prefrontal cortex that says, wait a bit, hold on, maybe don't do this right here, right now. So it checks on our impulsive behavior. Mm-hmm. The other thing it does is that it regulates our emotions. So let's face it, we all get angry at times. What stops us lashing out? It's the prefrontal cortex that again says, no, this is not the right time to, blow a fuse and lash out at someone. I mean, you can think of it as the guardian angel on behavior.
Right.
that keeps a lid on all those, hot-blooded emotions that we feel.
Yeah.
But the problem is if that part of the brain is not functioning well, it's a bit like the guardian angel on behavior is asleep.
Yep.
And if the guardian angel is asleep, the devil can come out.
Right. So you've spoken about diet and, alcohol and things like that. As far as the fetus is concerned, you've also spoken about how it could be genetic, right? Hereditary. But what about nurture? Can someone develop these tendencies as a result of the environment or their surroundings?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, let's take damage to the frontal region of the brain. If you shake a baby, maybe because it's crying, then what will happen is that the brain will rock backwards and forwards inside the skull, and the very frontal region of the brain will get bruised or damaged, and that can lead to the type of prefrontal lobe impairments that leads to impulsivity and emotional discontrol, which predisposes to crime and violence. So something in the environment, something as simple as shaking a baby, can actually be an environmental cause of the brain impairments that we've seen. Poor nutrition, as I've said, can also be an environmental cause of this. Or having a head injury. You can be an adult, have a head injury. And in fact, neurologists have documented that if people have a head injury that affects the very frontal region of the brain, their personalities can change overnight and they can become antisocial and impulsive, make bad decisions.
We are in control when the prefrontal cortex is developed well. And as you said, if there is damage in some way or another, then it affects impulsivity. I think the key word here is really impulsivity, isn't it? But what determines, even if there is slight damage, I mean, you mentioned something about fish oil. How would that help with thought and action? How will that help cushion that impact?
You know, all thoughts, all actions, they come from the brain. There's absolutely no question of that. So if you take something like fish oil, omega-3, omega-3 is a long-chain fatty acid. It's actually something that's very critical to brain structure and function. It enhances the connectivity of a neuron, a brain cell, to other brain cells in the brain. It increases the size of the neuron. It increases the lifespan of the neuron. So here we have a very simple substance that's contained in fish that we've known for a long time can enhance the structure and functioning of the brain. And what we've been doing is we've been giving fish oil to children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some children get a fruit drink containing fish oil, and the control group get the same fruit drink, but it doesn't contain the omega-3. What we then do is we measure the antisocial behavior at the beginning of the study, at the end of the study, and 6 months after they've finished with the omega-3. And what we're finding is that the omega-3 is improving the child's behavior. Their aggressive behavior goes down, their impulsive behavior goes down, and surprisingly, it lasts even for 6 months after we finish the treatment. So what we think we're doing here with this nutritional supplement is we're improving the brain. And if you improve the brain, you can improve behavior. You can improve thought, actions, impulse control, and emotion regulation.
Is there enough evidence to back up this claim?
That's a very good question. You know, the key study here is what's called a randomized control trial, meaning a bit like what I've described. You randomize some people to getting the treatment, and the other kids or adults are randomized to get a placebo treatment, in this case, a fruit drink not containing the omega-3. The work is just beginning, but so far, two randomized control trials have been done on prisoners, one in England, showing that after 5 months, omega-3 reduces serious offending in the prison by about 30 to 35%. The Ministry of Justice in the Netherlands heard about that, and they said, "Ooh, this sounds a bit fishy, this story of giving fish to felons. Mm-hmm. Is that really true?" So they did their replication study quite independently, and they found just the same thing. Now what we're doing is we're saying, right, well, prisoners are one thing. How about kids? Just normal kids in the community. And so far, we're beginning to find there is some evidence of effectiveness. But, you know, nutrition is a fatty area, and what we really do need are more studies like this, both on prisoners and just normal kids in the community, to see if there's something that's really there, something that really works.
Coming up next, we'll find out if maybe Eskimos could be lesser predisposed to violence as a result of consumption of fish. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. If you have just joined us, welcome. It is The Bigger Picture. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. On the phone with me, Adrian Raine, Professor of Criminology, Psychiatry and Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. We're discussing the anatomy of violence. Adrian, just before we left, you were discussing the impact of fish oil on the brain and how that could help with impulsivity and all sorts of behavioral issues. But Adrian, does that mean Eskimos are less violent people than the rest of us?
It's a really interesting question. I actually do not have data on homicide rates amongst Eskimos.
Yeah.
But Joe Hiblin, a leading expert on omega-3 in the National Institute of Alcoholism, he produced a fascinating study where he measured fish consumption in 26 different countries and plotted that data against homicide rates in those countries, and he found a strong relationship. So let me give you an example. People in Japan eat their whole body weight of fish every year, over 150 pounds of fish each person consumes.
Mm-hmm.
Japan has very low homicide rates. In contrast, Eastern European countries have high homicide rates and they have low fish consumption. Actually, the United States is just like those Eastern European countries. Low fish consumption, high homicide rates. So there is a correlation, there is a relationship. The more fish that's eaten in a country, the less the homicide rate.
Now, that is very interesting.
It's interesting, of course. Mind you, it's only a correlation.
Yeah.
You know, one reason why there's more homicide in America is they have guns. So, you know, we can't put too much into just a relationship. But this is where we get back to those randomized controlled trials. We manipulate the amount of omega-3 somebody is taking, and we see a reduction in their antisocial behavior. That's the proof of the pudding, whether a randomized controlled trial can show an effect. And again, these studies are initial, they're just beginning, but I think it's not just food for thought, it's increasingly food for court. I think the ministries of justice are increasingly interested in whether nutrition could play a role in reducing aggression, violence, and antisocial behavior in society.
But isn't violence our natural behavior for survival going back in time?
It is, at an adaptive level. I mean, let's face it, in wartime, you know, we want people on the front line who will pull a trigger, kill someone, and have no sense of remorse. In peacetime, those individuals, psychopaths who lack conscience, lack remorse, lack guilt, and aren't concerned about killing people, well, we put them in prison. So it is true that there are certain times in society where a certain degree of aggression is important. And, you know, when you turn to psychopaths, these are people who lack remorse, they lack conscience. They're not concerned about doing damage to people. They're also charming, they're also glib, they're very persuasive. Well, some of those characteristics are found in successful people. For example, successful politicians.
Mm-hmm.
They need to sort of con and manipulate, they at least need to persuade. I mean, they may not be bad people in any sense of the word, but sure as heck, they do need to persuade people in order to win the vote. Sometimes they have to make very tough decisions that can harm people. Sometimes they have to be cold-blooded and almost lacking remorse and lacking conscience in order to, you know, do something important, introducing a policy which can help the country in hand. So it's interesting that some of these qualities we see in offenders can also be adaptive in some places in society.
So can you predict violent behaviors? I mean, I'm just thinking you just do an fMRI of the prefrontal cortex and you should be able to tell a lot of things from there.
Well, we actually can do that. And in fact, this is very new science, but there are two studies that have come out in the last year which do show that brain imaging helps us predict which people are more likely to be violent in the future. Let me give you one example of that. We did a study last year, and my colleague is Dustin Pardini in Pittsburgh in the United States. And what we did is we brain scanned young offenders in the community. And we used the brain imaging data to try and see which individuals are more likely to commit a violent offense in the next 4 years. There's a part of the brain called the amygdala. It's the emotion center that gives us a sense of conscience, remorse, guilt. What we found is that if people had a reduced volume in this part of the brain, almost the moral part of the brain, those individuals were four times more likely to commit a violent act in the next 3 years. And that's prediction over and above other predictors like past history of violence, how psychopathic they were, and their employment records. So we are beginning to believe that biological data, brain imaging data, can in the future help us make better predictions of who is and is not going to commit a violent act in the future.
But then again, by studying this, Adrian, don't you think there would be other implications of, doing these brain images?
Yes, I think there are civil liberties concerns here because, you know, it's one thing to think about, let's do brain scans on prisoners to decide who we should release early,
yep,
people who are safe and not likely to commit violence, versus which prisoners to keep in prison because, gosh, all the boxes are checked. They've got all the biological and social risk factors,
yep,
for future violence.
Mm-hmm.
That's all well and good, and I think a number of us would say, well, we're okay with that. But I think the concern would be, what if we turn those tools onto people in society who have not yet committed crime to try and predict which individuals amongst us are more likely to commit violence in the future? It's a bit like that movie Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise, mm-hmm, stopping crime before it starts. It's a bit like a 1984 scenario here. You know, when will our civil liberties be taken away from us because we happen to have a brain scan that looks like a violent offender? And I'm concerned about that because my brain scan looks very much like that of a man who killed 64 people in a 12-year period.
Wow.
So, you know, I've got some of the risk factors for antisocial behavior. I had poor nutrition as a child. I had birth complications. I have a low resting heart rate, which is another risk factor for crime. And a brain scan like a serial killer. So, you know, if we put this policy into operation, I would be one of the first people to be locked up, even before I committed any crime.
Yes. But
so there are concerns, and I'm concerned.
Has it been difficult to persuade your peers that violence has a biological basis? Because most criminal investigation studies seem to be centered around sociology.
Yes, absolutely. The study of crime is dominated by social scientists and sociological researchers. And they've always really turned their backs on the biology of crime. I think that's a mistake because, as I've said, the social factors, they are important, don't get me wrong. Bad environments, bad neighborhoods, racial discrimination, all of these things can, of course, predispose to crime. But it's only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is biological. And sociologists have buried their heads in the sands like ostriches, just trying to pretend that data doesn't exist. The danger of that is that if we ignore the biological causes of crime, we'll never stop violence. And the ostriches have better watch out because the hunters will be out there and they'll get shot.
Yep.
And, you know, my goal is really to try and persuade people that let's look at all factors together. That the more that we can tackle the multiple causes of crime, the more successful we are going to be in changing crime. It's very hard, for example, to make a bad neighborhood into a good neighborhood overnight. It's very, very hard. But if there's some simple nutritional tricks like omega-3 that can really make a difference, especially to children who are in most need, then what's eugenics about enriching the environment of a child and giving them better nutrition?
Your book, The Anatomy of Violence, was turned into a television drama of the same name by the creators of Homeland. Yes. How did that happen?
Well, Howard Gordon, who wrote Homeland, saw my book just before it was published, and he said, well, you know, I'd like to make this the next Homeland. And so he was able to get $8 million from CBS to create a pilot on The Anatomy of Violence. Unfortunately, that pilot did not move into TV, which was such a shame because the lead actor had the name Dr. Adrian Raine. Playing me. I was an FBI expert a real specialist on serial killers, helping a young female FBI agent track down a serial killer. I was so disappointed when it wasn't turned into a TV series, because as an academic, you know, what more could you want than having your own TV show?
Of course, you were involved in this directly, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I was consulting on that with Howard Gordon and the rest of the team. And it was fun going down to Los Angeles, seeing the filming. The actors were wonderful. Just one of those things, you know. It doesn't quite get turned into TV. But we're hoping that we'll have a documentary based on the anatomy of violence, which to me is important because my goal really is science education to the public, trying to translate to the public the new exciting scientific knowledge that we're finding that could give us new clues about stopping crime and violence.
Where do you hope to take this on after this?
Well, you know, I want to continue doing the treatment studies about trying to see how we can change the brain to change behavior. And just one other technique I'll mention, which I'm not doing research in yet, but I'd like to, it's called mindfulness training. I mean, you may be familiar with this. It's a form of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
What fascinates me is that randomized controlled trials have shown that people who do mindfulness training, their prefrontal cortex is more active and engaged well after they complete their mindfulness training. The amygdala, the emotion center of the brain, which is blunted in cold-blooded psychopaths, that is also activated in the long term by mindfulness training. So to me, again, these are benign, simple techniques which could be very cost-effective in changing the brain to reduce criminal behavior. So I think there are a lot of exciting avenues open to us for how we can change the brain to change behavior. But I think some people don't want to dabble with the brain. Is it really right for us to go into the holy of holies, the brain, the essence of ourselves, and change and manipulate that? That's an ethical concern some people have.
Your final message on neurocriminology?
The final message I can give is I think the best investment society can make in stopping crime in the future is investing in the early years of the child to enhance and enrich the environments of children, to give them stimulating environments with better nutrition, more physical exercise, cognitive stimulation, because we have done a study showing that if you do that for just 2 years, from age 3 to 5, you can reduce crime and violence by 33% 20 years later. And that's a simple message, but we need long-term thinking. And the trouble is politicians have really short lifespans, and they want results quickly. But I think we have to be more long-term thinkers here to really stop crime.
Right? Thank you for speaking with us, Adrian.
It's been a real pleasure.
Adrian Raine, Professor of Criminology, Psychiatry and Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, author of the book The Anatomy of Violence on Neurocriminology on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.